Hello, sir.
Well, hello again. Hi, my friend.
Hey, Roger. How you doing, pal?
All right.
Good to hear your voice.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
We are gathered here to discuss that rather extraordinary talk that you gave at the first annual Integral Conference, co-sponsored by JFK and Integral Institute. And you were good enough to transcribe it for publication in the ITP Integral Theory and Practice Journal. And it got such really great reviews. People just really, really loved it. It was a wonderful overview of the integral field and where it is and where we can expect it to go and the traps that we face in dealing with it, and really just a fantastic kind of miniature handbook of what's going on. So you were good enough to agree to come on board and just discuss the paper.
Well, thanks very much, Ken. And yeah, it was obviously a wonderful opportunity to be able to address that conference, which was really quite an extraordinary gathering, you know, to have some 500 people from all around the world gathered to explore the integral vision for effectively the first time in such a large international setting. So it was
an
extraordinary contribution. It was a real gift to be able to do that. And it was, you know, just a delight to be able to take the time to explore the integral movement, where it is and what's happening and what the potential might be. Of course, communicating in one medium, such as a talk, doesn't necessarily translate directly into other mediums, such as interview, dialogue, or discussion. So although I understand we can take that talk as a stepping-off point, I hope you and I will just engage in a dialogue, kind of free-form, and see spontaneous, hopefully creative, and see where it goes.
Well, yes, I thought, in a sense, we would do both. I'm going to read sections of the paper, and then you and I can just take off and discuss those.
Okay.
So that way we'll kind of cover both sides of the street. So let me just start by reading the abstract. The paper's in two parts. It's called The State of the Integral Enterprise. And part one is Current Status and Potential Traps. And part two is The Race Between Consciousness and Catastrophe, Key Ideas for a World at Risk. And the abstract to part one is as follows. Although integral ideas are spreading rapidly, the integral vision still remains the province of what sociologists call a cognitive minority. Extending and optimizing integral's impact will require many things from practitioners, especially high-quality work and becoming Gnostic intermediaries. Ways in which integral ideas can enhance practitioners' own lives are surveyed, and the paper then turns to potential traps that await both individuals and integral groups. These traps include, for example, egocentric misuse of integral ideas and insights, developmental complacency, spiritual materialism, metapathologies and meta-defenses, and failure to engage the mainstream. Possible antidotes to these traps are suggested so they can be transformed from stopping points into stepping stones. And the paper then begins, Integral Theory and the Integral Theory Conference are testaments to the power of vision. Here I would like to address some of the key issues at the heart of both this vision and of the integral enterprise. These issues include the state of the integral enterprise, the challenges we face, and the contributions we might make. To do this, I will explore the following topics and questions: the current status of the integral enterprise, how we can optimize the impact of integral ideas, applying integral ideas to one's own life, traps that await us, potential shadows and shortcomings. In part two of this paper, I will focus on crucial ideas to communicate to the culture, integral contributions to help our troubled world. Current status. The integral vision is a new one, first described in 1995 in Ken Wilber's Sex, Ecology, Spirituality. The vision and ideas have now spread worldwide and are being applied in an ever-growing range of fields. This conference alone covers topics as diverse as integral ecology, coaching, conflict resolution, and gender issues, as well as disciplines such as sociology, philosophy, psychology, and many more. However, integral still remains very much a minority perspective. This raises an important question. Is integral destined to remain the province of a cognitive minority? Possibly, because deep appreciation of its more mature forms requires several as yet unusual understandings and capacities. These include, for example, recognizing adult development stages, developing to a post-conventional second-tier stage oneself, using integral, especially integral aperspectival cognition, and openness to big pictures and complexity. So, point number one, recognizing adult development stages. You and I have discussed this a fair amount, and that is a staggeringly simple but huge problem that really just besets virtually all areas of the culture, doesn't it?
It does, and this is something you opened my eyes to. You tried hard over a lot of years, but it took a long time. And actually, you know, that's probably an important point for us to talk about, because it did take me a long time to wake up to just how important this is. And it wasn't because you didn't try to tell me.
Right.
You told me, you wrote about it in your books many times, and I said, yep, right, exactly. But it wasn't until I really immersed myself in a study of developmental psychology that developmental ideas and developmental stages went from essentially an object that I was looking at with kind of detached interest to actually a lens I was looking at the world through. And when I did, my goodness, the world changed. And I've said to a number of people that really studying and integrating developmental ideas, ideas around adult psychological development,
right,
feel like they've stretched my worldview more than anything else in the last several years.
Yeah. It is a eye-opening adventure. And what it basically points to is that there simply is not a single world out there, that the world that we see is a product of perception and conception. That is to say, it's in part an interpretation. And that interpretation depends on the psychological and mental tools that we have to interpret it with. And those tools develop, like virtually everything else in nature, they grow and develop. And they do so through a series of broad stages of unfolding, stages of growth and development, stages of evolution. And simply by studying, learning these stages, it really changes almost entirely the way you look at the world and the way you look at how other people look at the world.
If you'd told me that just a few years ago, I would have nodded my head in agreement and I wouldn't have been getting it.
Yeah. It's something that I think takes, as you know, you can comment on as well, but it's something that not only do you have to sort of study the essential points, it really helps to be in a community of people who are using them, so that when we see on the news at night another tidbit from the culture wars, we can realize pretty easily that these culture wars are essentially, it's very complex, but at their heart are three different major stages of human development. And these stages, to use Gene Gepser's simple version, go from archaic to magic to mythic to rational to pluralistic to integral and higher. And the three largest groups of people in this country are at stages that are mythic or fundamentalist, absolutistic, mythic membership stages, and then rational or modern scientific enlightenment values, and then pluralistic or postmodern, cultural creative, multicultural understandings. And those, the three in the middle, the fundamentalist religious values, the scientific rational values, and the postmodern cultural creative values, those are the three main contestants in the culture wars. And people at those different stages of development are taking up interpretations of the world, and because they don't know that they're merely interpretations, they think they're seeing reality itself, and so they think the other person is just categorically absolutely wrong. And so off we go. And being able to see how developmental stages help explain the world around you and being able to discuss it with people sort of helps. But because there's such a disproportionate lack of embrace, of understanding and embrace of developmental ideas, it's not something that you're likely to hear talked about.
Yes, and I want to make sure that something you said, because you actually said an awful lot there, put out a lot of ideas, and I want to make sure one of them doesn't get lost, because it was particularly relevant for me, I think, in this, but also for a lot of others. And you said that it really helps to have a community who are aware of this, and I think that was one of the things which hindered my recognition of the really appreciating the importance of adult
right.
development was, I live in a world, an academic world, where that just is not recognized. And,
right.
and I had a recurrent experience of coming out to visit you and being with an integral community, and it's like, oh, yeah, my, this is important. And then I go back into my world and forget it. So I just want to make sure that doesn't get lost, because I think that one of the themes you and I have talked about a lot and encouraged is the idea of Sangha community, the importance of peers and, of course, teachers who can match and lead you into in development. And certainly that's been a very clear experience for me, the value of, say, for example, visiting you and the integral community and being immersed in this not only developmental perspective, but integral worldview and perspective.
Right.
And just one imbibes it. And, when you and I were living together as with Francis many years ago, when you were, before your marriage to Treya, that
right.
Even back then, we discussed and recognized there was something very valuable that came from having friends who were exploring these edges, and how valuable
right.
it was to have that kind of communication. So
right.
just want to make sure that point you alluded to, the importance of peers and community for
right.
an appreciation of not only developmental ideas, but integral ideas as a whole,
right.
doesn't get lost.
Right. And as we'll see later in one of your headings, good company sharing adequate and fundamentally accurate ideas is one of the single most important practices that one can do to pick up wisdom. And so that it's certainly true in this case. And we'll come back to this, because you highlight it again and really go into some of the difficulties about adult development and the necessity to really look at it carefully and take it seriously, because we do not have a one-size-fits-all, a bunch of people running around driven solely by rational self-interest and having no other motivations, drives, needs, or values. There's an entire spectrum of multiple intelligences, maybe a dozen multiple intelligences, and they all grow and develop. They all go through stages. And this is just so crucial to understand in terms of how individuals see the world. And so we will come back to that. Your second point is developing the post-conventional second-tier stages oneself. And that means, of course, not just studying these developmental maps and realizing that they apply to people out there, but applying them to oneself and realizing that these are fundamentally maps of the territory of our own being. They're maps of the territory of you and the territory of me and the territory of our own awareness. And because they're carefully, one might say scientifically, checked, they point to higher and deeper and wider territories that we might not be aware of. But these developmental studies show us that, wait, not only does development go through lower stages of pre-rational and rational, it goes through higher transrational stages. It goes through not only pre-conventional and conventional stages of development, it goes into post-conventional and post-post-conventional. And these are aspects of our own being. And not surprisingly, integral ideas are ideas that emerge preeminently from some of these higher stages. So in order for us to get it, we have to get our own development.
Yeah. Yes, that's certainly, I think that's one of the key points of the whole integral theory.
Right. Next point is using integral, especially integral A perspectival cognition. And this means, of course, simply applying some of the qualities and characteristics of these higher stages.
Right. And let's see, we're still going through at the moment, I think, some of the requirements for being an effective as an integral practitioner.
Right. And some of the reasons that integral might remain a cognitive minority is that these qualities that we're going through now are the qualities that are necessary in order to really get integral, and they're fairly rare qualities right now.
Yeah, yeah.
So using integral, especially integral aperspectival cognition, another fairly rare quality that is nonetheless indispensable to developing an integral perspective.
Right.
Openness to big pictures and complexity.
Yeah, it's interesting that that doesn't necessarily go along with having the cognitive capacity. This came home to me very clearly when I was talking with a colleague when I was one of the first times at the university I tried to explain these weird integral things I was into. And I sat down with this actually very eminent neuroscientist who
yeah.
was actually led a major government institution and tried to, you know, fumbled along, tried to explain how I was into this, and, you know, the meaning of life and integrating everything in the universe and inner and outer and blah, blah, blah. And he looked at me and he nodded his head and said, yeah, you know, I understand. I've gone through a similar shift myself, you know. I used to just be interested in studying the nucleus of the neuron. Now I'm interested in the whole neuron. I was like, okay, yeah, that's it, right? So
one of the things, of course, that the integral framework claims to do is make room for most of the really fundamental disciplines that human beings have taken up. And this includes behaviorism and empiricism. It includes phenomenology and developmental structuralism. It includes semiotics and ethnomethodology and hermeneutics. It includes systems theory. Cognitive systems theory, and big pictures that pull all of those together are extremely rare. And as a matter of fact, we've gone through a period over the last 20 or 30 years where they've been discouraged, actively discouraged. And postmodernism itself can be sort of summarized with the view that, quote, there are no big pictures. So we've lost that. And what has become obvious in the last decade or so, as postmodernism itself is recognized to have itself a big picture, postmodernism, in explaining why there are no big pictures, reverts to things like, well, all knowledge is relative and knowledge is a social product and there are no universals. And the knowledge we have is all an interpretation. But all of those things I said, postmodernism maintains are true for every single culture, bar none. In other words, they have a universal big picture. And so it's self-contradictory, and the so-called performative contradiction has been one of the main items that have led people from Jürgen Habermas to Karl Otto Appel to, in a sense, fatally wound the postmodern claim. And so big pictures are now slowly coming back. And one of the reasons that big pictures help is just, I mean, you're fond of quoting psychologists who say that by large, you know, noble visions, mankind is ennobled, and by small, meager visions, mankind is reduced. And these big pictures basically point to the fact that the universe is one. The universe is a grand, unified, beautiful organism, in a sense. And there is a way to find room in the universe for virtually every major human endeavor, that everybody is partially right. And this is so ennobling and so opening and so inviting, and so non-oppressive in a fundamental sense.
Indeed, and you were talking about the beauty of the universe and how it fits. I'm actually sitting at the moment looking out over the San Francisco Bay, so you kind of took me into a very pleasant altered state just with your description as I was looking out.
But big pictures are coming back. And,
there does seem to have been a shift in a variety of fields that now almost kosher to talk about some of these big picture syntheses.
Yes, indeed. One of America's finest sociologists said that sociology has gone through three phases in the last century. The first was sort of monolithic big pictures. These were things like the Marxist vision or the Hegelian vision, and were kind of clunky in their unified vision and ended up being kind of reductionistic, even though they were trying to be holistic. And then it went through a period of microanalysis over the last 30 years. And microanalysis just was the postmodern approach throughout all big pictures and settled on nothing but the analysis of individuals in their day-to-day life. It would do, when you do historical studies, you do not study somebody as being the product of the Enlightenment. You study them just as they are in their everyday setting. You do not apply labels and pictures and theories to them because that diminishes them. Of course, there's some truth to that, but you can go way, way, way too far. And as a sociologist pointed out, and he said, now we're entering a third phase, which he himself called the integral age. And in that, we're starting to see big pictures come back, but in a sense, as a combination of the previous two phases, a big picture, big vision impulse, but tempered with fine analysis and understanding that these are just maps and not the territory, and care not to use these maps to dominate or oppress or exclude individuals. And so under that rubric, the integral age is, we are hoping, on its way in.
May it be so.
May it be so. But that's exactly right, as one of the difficulties is openness to big pictures and complexity.
Yeah.
How can we optimize the contributions of integral ideas is the next heading. Optimizing integral contributions will require a great deal of us. It will require that we cultivate our individual and collective learning, maturation, mastery, and effectiveness. Obviously, this is a large topic and a lifelong challenge opportunity. Here I will mention only two key requirements: careful work and becoming Gnostic intermediaries. Careful work as the first one. That's certainly a foundation, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I think that's going to be the challenge, certainly, for taking what is at the moment outside the mainstream and bringing it in. I mean, the criterion, there's a reason that, one, there are a lot of reasons why the mainstream in the intellectual world is the mainstream, but one of them is there are certain standards and criteria.
Right.
And so there should be.
Right.
And we have to match and actually better them. We have to, if we're going to have an effect and be accepted within the mainstream intellectual world and scientific and related intellectual worlds, then we have to be able to play their game and play it well.
Right. And this requires an understanding of the mainstream world itself in addition to the integral vision that we want to bring to it. So that's a double difficult task for us, if you will, because we're required to show careful work in two areas, if you will. And that's part of what you call becoming Gnostic intermediaries, which you open the discussion of that by saying integral effectiveness will also require something more. It will require that we become Gnostic intermediaries. What is a Gnostic mediary? The term was used by Carl Jung to refer to Wilhelm, the translator of the I Ching. Jung suggested that Wilhelm embodied the wisdom of the I Ching so deeply that he was able to transmit not only the ideas, but also the deeper underlying spirit of Chinese culture. Jung does not seem to have developed the concept further. However, I define a Gnostic intermediary as a person who is able to effectively translate and transmit wisdom from one culture or community to another. What does this require? Well, it seems to require three tasks and three corresponding capacities. First, one must imbibe and become the wisdom itself, because while one can have knowledge, one must be wise. This, of course, is no small task. In fact, when we are talking about profound spiritual wisdom, it can easily take a lifetime. And that is, nonetheless, part of the charge of what is given to us, isn't it?
It is indeed, yeah. And it is important, for us to recognize that the part of what we're talking about for integral, really imbibing and utilizing integral vision is cultivating wisdom, and that's, as you were saying, no small challenge, but it is the first requirement, it seems, for being a Gnostic intermediary. And I did like that term of Jung's. I wish we'd done more with it, but I just think it's a very useful idea, that pointing to the fact that transmitting wisdom from one culture to another really does require something more than simply the communication of knowledge.
Right.
It really does require that we first have imbibed some of that wisdom ourselves.
Right.
And then, secondly, it seems to require that we, as you were talking about before, we really know and even master the conceptual framework and language of the people we want to communicate to. And then third, it requires translational abilities.
Right.
That we are able to literally translate or source the wisdom afresh in the language and concepts of the people and communities with which we want to communicate.
Right.
And that just seems a very important challenge and even just idea to know what's involved there.
Right.
That's essentially what we're doing. And of course, every age requires its own Gnostic intermediaries, because spiritual and transpersonal ideas, even before they were recognized as transpersonal, transconventional, required communicating afresh to each culture and each generation.
Right.
So
right.
We're just putting words around or giving concepts to something that's been an ongoing challenge for every spiritual tradition and every transpersonal vision.
Right. Ever since you've run across that phrase, you've been using it, and I agree, it's a beautiful concept and really does encapsulate the essence of what is required to get the integral vision from one culture, mainly a cognitive minority, into another culture, mainly the cognitive majority, whether it's in the culture at large or universities and so on. The second requirement of Gnostic intermediaries is linguistic and conceptual competence. They must understand the language and conceptual system of the people and culture to whom they wish to communicate. And you briefly mentioned that, but that is a cornerstone of requirement, isn't it?
Yeah, and basically it's restating what we were just talking about, the fact that in order to be able to communicate effectively to a community, and each of us will be communicating to a specific, not only community, but discipline, probably,
right.
Then we have to really be masters of the discipline.
Right.
And if we're going to be integral psychologists, for example, then, of course, we need to know psychology well.
Yeah.
Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera,
yeah.
For every other discipline.
Yeah. Again, pointing to the fact that there's sort of two disciplines that a Gnostic intermediary needs to know. The third requirement is translational. They must be able to translate the wisdom from the wisdom-bearing culture into the language and conceptual system of the recipient culture in such a way as to create an aha experience of understanding. Of course, this requires recognizing and speaking to the developmental level of the recipients, and better still, speaking in ways that can be appreciated at multiple levels. And this capacity to embody a wisdom, and then it's a different capacity or a different intelligence to be able to communicate it effectively and clearly and with vibrancy and clarity. And that's an extraordinary capacity, but one that we're also called on if we're to speak and produce something other than just a muddle of babbled words.
Yes, of course, this isn't a new idea. I think of, for example, Mahayana Buddhism with its distinction between self-awakening and skillful means, the capacity to communicate and teach effectively.
Right.
And, having, traveled, been fortunate enough to travel to various parts of the world and learn from a variety of teachers, I've learned that enlightenment does not a teacher make. I think I've learned a lot more in some cases from some teachers who have been, by their own acknowledgement, would say they're nowhere near as advanced as some of the masters I've been fortunate to meet, but
right.
They're just very skillful in communicating and teaching.
Right, and something that, we're all continuing to work on in ourselves. And I have a great deal of appreciation for those Gnostic intermediaries who do have this capacity. Not only do they have this presence that seems to radiate in many ways, but they can transmit that, and often verbally, in really clear and effective ways. And you can think really of any, whether we're talking specifically about the integral vision or talking about Buddhism, you can think of somebody like Martin Luther King and his capacity to speak and move people to tears, really, is a really good example of a Gnostic intermediary trying to communicate love and compassion, which is certainly a minority in too many cases, and do it in a way that's so effective. Applying integral ideas to one's own life. It's one thing to apply integral ideas to the world. It's another to apply them to ourselves. How can this be done? The possibilities include the following. I'll just read them and then we'll discuss them. Study, inspiration, growth disciplines, self-assessment, developmental assessment, growth-oriented relationships. So study, becoming familiar with integral ideas is essential for effective application of the integral vision to both our life and work. Study allows us to see and think more integrally and to use and apply integral frameworks more effectively. Of course, mastery is a lifelong process, but a foundational one, isn't it?
It is, yes, and I think one of the differences here with more mainstream study is that this study is a starting point for anyone in a spiritual tradition or wanting to embody an integral vision. That you start with study, but it really is only the groundwork and frame from which you then hopefully, or we take on the lifelong challenge of maturation, increasing our maturity and effectiveness.
Right. And I think that's a good way to look at it, too. Study as being sort of necessary but not sufficient for being a Gnostic intermediary. Inspiration. Studying integral ideas can inspire us. This inspiration will take multiple forms and find its unique expression in each of us. However, one kind may be crucial for all of us. This is the inspiration first to work to mature towards the higher states and stages that the integral vision describes, and second, to serve the same maturation in others. So that's an inspiration, again, for development and developmental depth.
Yeah, and I think, ideally, simply knowing that these things are possible
right.
can pull and call us.
One of the reasons that developmental psychology and developmental studies in general, studying the stages of contemplation and meditation, for example, are so important is that they show us that there is a there, that there is a path to these higher states and stages. One can actually follow this path, and that it's real, and that it can be really effectively studied in so many ways. And that's inspiring, because we can actually look at that and look at the saints and sages who have made that pilgrimage to their own higher self. St. Teresa's seven castles, to Sufi works, to Buddha Gosha's Visuddhimagga, to any of these great spiritual works are, by their nature, very, very inspiring.
Yeah, yes, they certainly have that potential. Some of them more than others, of course.
Right.
But yes.
Growth disciplines. Another general kind of inspiration is to take up growth disciplines. We can usefully draw from an array of practices, including psychotherapy, relationship and group work, somatic practices, service, and, of course, spiritual contemplative disciplines. Possible practice include the full array of traditional disciplines, contemporary therapies, and integral life practices. It does say one thing above all others, and that is that more important than study, more important than being inspired, is actual practice, actually doing it yourself.
Yeah, and we've talked about the fact that there's just no substitute for that, that taking up some form of discipline which fosters one's own deepening or growth or development, whatever metaphor you want to use, just is crucial for so many things. Firstly, for integrating an integral perspective and opening to an integral perspective, and also for effectively communicating it and being effective in the world. It just seems to be a cornerstone, and it's no accident that if you look at what the great sages have said, I mean, if there's basically they've begged us to take up the disciplines they've offered.
Right. Yes. You know, I leave you not a god, I leave you a path. And to practice that is our real calling. And, you know, you and I have been talking a fair bit about spirituality. And that is because spirituality is an extremely crucial component. If you have to pick one component, then it's the most important component of an integral vision. And, of course, integral vision includes art and science and history and poetry and so on. But spirituality, both in terms of studying it from the exterior and practicing it from the interior, is a utterly precious and necessary component of any genuine life practice. And one of the things that makes an integral vision and an integral practice so important is that it is able to take the world's great contemplative traditions and show how they fit in with modern and postmodern studies, so that we do get a little bit bigger picture of the world that includes pre-modern, modern, and postmodern endeavors. And spirituality, absolutely one of those.
Indeed, and certainly it's one of the distinguishing features of the integral perspective from most mainstream intellectual disciplines, for sure.
Yeah.
You know, integral has added another couple of stories to the intellectual system.
And we'll also see in just a minute that there are at least two different types of spirituality and how crucially important it is to understand that distinction. When we say take up spirituality, we don't mean take up being an absolutistic, fundamentalist, ethnocentric individual. We do mean take up a psychotechnology for transforming consciousness. Self-assessment. We can also use integral theory to foster self-assessment. For example, we can use integral ideas as an integral operating system to recognize the quadrant and perspective we are looking from and help recognize perspectives and possibilities we have been overlooking.
Yes, I think that's really one of the gifts of the integral vision. Is just it does keep calling us to recognize there are other ways of looking at things.
Yeah, I think we sometimes say that the actual integral framework is psychoactive because it sort of seems to go through your system and put up a red flag whenever you're leaving something out. So first person, second person, and third person methodologies, which one of them are right? Well, the integral vision suggests all of them are equally right and equally important and equally needed. So if we're working on consciousness studies, for example, we don't just take third-person studies that look at the brain and its structure and its neurotransmitters and its electrical patterns, but we look at first-person phenomenology and introspection and meditation and contemplation. And these give an entirely different world space. And what the integral vision does as a self-assessment is just say, are you including all of these? Just, you know, it doesn't tell you what to think or how to think, but it does say if you're approaching a particular topic, please consider taking all of these avenues into account, because all of them seem to be extremely important.
Yes, that's one of the gifts of this approach. I think it just does offer that stimulus and reminder to keep looking and incorporating all those views.
Right. Developmental assessment. Another possibility, at least theoretically, is to use the integral map to assess our own level of development. For example, it is sometimes suggested that we can use the integral psychograph to map our own developmental levels on various developmental lines. However, this is a slippery claim because self-assessment is difficult, the shadow subtle, and self-deception impressive. We all have erroneous self-images, potent defenses, and numerous blind spots, and these make self-assessment challenging. My wife, an experienced psychotherapist, summarizes the problem by saying, "Never underestimate the power of denial."
Yes, indeed. That's my wife. Right, and she says it to me a lot. Yeah, and I think there has been, talk of using the integral psychograph to assess our own developmental level, and I'm just not clear on how effective we can hope to be with this.
Right.
And later we'll probably talk about the importance of relationship and second-person
right.
perspectives for that kind of assessment.
Right.
It's so much easier to assess other people
than yourself. In the meantime, it sort of stands as a wide invitation to, if we can't get, determine our level precisely, to at least keep open in ourselves all of these higher and wider and deeper potentials that are on the map. So it just acts as a spur for our own growth and development, even if we can't necessarily pin it down.
Right.
Growth-oriented relationships. So here we come to some help with the power of denial. We need honest feedback from other people, second-person perspectives, to compensate for our own blind spots. After all, it's far easier to see other people's limitations than our own. And 2,000 years ago, Jesus famously asked, "Why do you see the speck in your neighbor's eye, but do not notice the log in your own?" Therefore, relationship aimed at recognizing and releasing psychological, spiritual, and developmental limitations are invaluable. There is no substitute for dialogue and feedback. Of course, there are many ways to obtain feedback. These include authentic relationships, as well as formal disciplines such as psychotherapy, counseling, and coaching. However, perhaps the supreme method for obtaining second-person feedback and coaching are intimate relationships and marriage. One of the best tests of enlightenment may be that of psychiatrist Arthur Diekman, who suggests, ask the spouse.
Oh, good. the heart of Confucianism is that wonderful idea. You know, if you want to set first the state or the country right, first set right your own, your own area, and then your own family. And it's like, when I read that first, I thought, yeah, that's a cute idea. But my goodness, I've come to think that man is saying something very important.
Yeah, an entire civilization was really constructed around his ideas, just like that, of relationships and governance. And one can see why it produced the beautiful, extraordinary legend of culture and civilization that China was. If you're going to build a culture on a set of rules, his aren't too shabby. Starting with that one, if you want to get the government working, look to your own house.
Yeah, it's really true. And the more one is exposed to, has the opportunity of being with people who have a lot of name recognition or fame, one recognizes that a public persona can be very different from family or relationship
right.
persona, and that
right.
in some ways it's a lot easier to be an impressive public figure than
right.
just to be impressive in intimate relationships. So
right.
you've got to keep intimate relationships up or that up all the time.
Yeah, yeah. You then say, which I think is very useful, one of the most effective ways I know of to transform a relationship into a powerful facilitator of growth is this: make an explicit agreement to use the relationship for mutual learning and awakening. Once that agreement is made, you have given each other permission to tell the truth, give feedback, and do whatever best serves your mutual learning, healing, growth, and awakening. That is a terrific idea and suggestion.
Yeah, it does seem that That can be a real gift to any relationship. If, of course, it requires a lot of people. That really does require that you do want to learn and grow and awaken. But for anyone who does, it's so facilitating and empowering if there's an explicit agreement between people that we want the relationship to serve a higher function. We want it to serve, and ideally, I think, we want the relationship to serve our mutual learning and awakening, and also contribution.
Right.
That is, that ideally the relationship serves a purpose larger than either individual, larger than itself,
right,
and is offered in service to service, as well as to awakening. Of course, that gets pretty close to a relational bodhisattvic aspiration.
Right. Right. One can see why the bodhisattva ideal has been such a powerful and powerfully motivating ideal for millions and millions of Buddhist practitioners over the years. And it's had quite an effect on Western culture that's been exposed to it. It is one of the most beautiful and ennobling ideas that human beings have come up with. And, of course, it's absolutely part of integral practice and is included that way. So it's a really good reminder.
Yeah, and it's just if something happens in a relationship or in a group where there's a shared agreement that
right.
we're going to use our time and being together in our relationship in the service of our mutual learning, awakening, and contribution. It really does. Something magical happens.
I really like the phrase and the word specifically. Once that agreement is made, you have given each other permission to tell the truth, give feedback, and do whatever best serves your mutual learning, healing, growth, and awakening. Getting permission and giving it. There's something about that, isn't it? Because we don't have permission from our culture to tell the truth. And so in a relationship, to give each other that permission, it just seems such a crucial idea itself, just permission.
Yeah, there's something, you're right. There's something very important about that. Most relationships are at least covertly based in part on a shared covert agreement. I won't call you on your act if you don't call me on mine.
Right.
And so relationships, not necessarily intentionally, but, we have unconsciousness. and most relationships serve to protect one's fears and defenses and neuroses, etc. So this is a way of cutting through that.
So if you want to turn a relationship from what it normally is, which is a mutual admiration society, into something that serves your own growth and transformation, give each other the permission to tell the truth. And then fasten your seatbelt.
Right, yes. It won't necessarily be easy, but it probably will be valuable.
Yeah.